Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRTPC call on the 20th of December 2011. On the call today, we have James Liddell, Bob Mountain, Mike O'Connor, Matt Serlin, Barbara Steele, Jonathan Tenenbaum, and Rob Golding. From staff, we have Marika Koenigs and myself, Natalie Peregrine. We have apologies from Paul Diaz and Michaela Nalem. I would like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. And apologies if I have missed anyone else. We're having meeting issues today. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, depending on your location. And thanks for joining the IRTPC working group call for December 20th. As Natalie mentioned, we're having some issues with meeting view. So if your name was not heard in the roll, or if you join later, please let us know either through Adobe or later so that we can correct the transcript. First item, of course, is to ask if anyone has any updated statements of interest. And also, I believe that we have addressed our outstanding SOI issues that we've had as far as the initiation of this working group. Is that correct, Rika, or do we still have one or two holdouts?
Yeah, this is Rick. I think we still have one person who hasn't submitted an SOI, but neither has attended any of the calls, so we're basically sending that person a last warning, and if we don't get any response, the person will be removed from the mailing list, and the other person who hadn't submitted one indicated that he no longer wishes to be part of the working group, so we'll remove his list as well. And I think then there's just one person that just needs to submit their statement according to the new model, but we're sending some further reminders on that note.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so then the second item on the agenda is to discuss an update of our outreach efforts for SOs and ACs. I know that Aubrey did a fantastic job. Oh, I see that she's joined. So, Aubrey, if you don't mind, if you're on the call, we can get an update on this. I saw that the letter was sent out, and I thought it was excellent. Do you have anything to add?
No. First of all, just apologies for being late. Just found out my car was dead at inspection, so I was commiserating with my partner about what we do next. The letters went out. Thank you very much to Glenn and Marika for doing that. Have gotten one acknowledgement, I believe, from ALAC, Olivier and ALAC, saying, thank you, they'll look into it, and that's all.
Okay, thanks. I'm sorry to hear about your car.
Thank you. Now I got to buy a new one.
I hope that works out for you, especially around the holidays. That's never fun. And just kind of building on that, we did, Rick and I were discussing before the call started that we have still received a grand total of zero responses to our call for public comment. So if folks are intending to comment either individually or on behalf of their companies or on behalf of their stakeholder groups, please be please be aware that the comment period closes on the 22nd. I think that stakeholder groups have a little bit longer time for that feedback. But anyway, that comment period is active but closing quickly. Which then brings us to item number 3. And just a status update, we'll put Mr. Mountain on the spot here briefly. Bob, can you give us an update on where the sub-team is at in compiling those examples?
Absolutely. Thanks, James. This is Bob speaking. We've been moving forward. We now have two use cases that Simonetta and I had done. One is transferring a domain from Dynadot to GoDaddy. And the other is transferring it from one registrant account at GoDaddy to another account at GoDaddy. So those are both done, and the draft of that deck has been circulated to the volunteers, the 5 or 6 folk who had been agreed to help out. We're expecting a couple of more use cases before we finalize the deck and then circulate it to the larger team. I think I expect those any day now. So hopefully before the next call, we'll have those done. One comment, the process has been, I think we were surprised at how many steps the process took, even though both Simonetta and I had been through that before. One use case was approximately 50 slides. So there's a lot of steps to go through in one of these things, and I think you'll all see that when you get a look at the deck, which again, I think it's coming along nicely, and hopefully we'll have it wrapped up in a week.
Ouch. Okay, 50 slides. Nice. Well, thanks for the update. I see we have Avery in the queue. Avery,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. It sounds good. One question I had is, and you say you have more cases coming. Is one of the cases one where you're both changing owner and transferring to another registrar at the same time?
Yeah, the first one is. It's the domain that I had with Dynadot.
Oh, okay. So that was both. Okay, I missed that. Thanks.
Yeah. No, sorry if I wasn't clear on that. So.
And Bob, I put myself in the queue. I think you have a question. I had a question, but I think you may have already answered it, which is that you expect that this would be ready for discussion in our next call, which is not next week, but the following week, January 3rd, I think.
Yeah, I believe so. This is Bob. We're expecting, you know, two more use cases, which people have told me I should get any day. So as long as those are delivered, then we should be fine. Yeah.
Okay, great. Jonathan.
Yeah, this is Jonathan here. We'll have a use case within the next day or so. And Bob, while we're on the line, is there a particular? I think it was Aubrey that had asked about one that changes ownership. Is there any other particular kind of transfer that we want for the case? I guess is there any other particular kind of transfer, any other kind of nuanced thing that we want to address, or?
Like I said, it should be different registrar choices than we've made. So we have Dynadot to GoDaddy and GoDaddy to GoDaddy. So we should probably pick, I would say, registrar to a different registrar, both change of ownership as well as change of registrar, just so we have another example of that.
Sure.
I think. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no, I was going to say we're going to utilize NetSol on one side and Register.com on the other. And then as far as ownership, we can do whatever we want. I mean, we could either, have it with the same owner, maybe we'll do two cases with the same, utilizing the two of them. We'll do one where the ownership doesn't change and one where the ownership is changing. We'll move it from one entity to another or something like that.
Yeah, this is Bob. That actually makes sense because we don't currently have a same registrant, different registrar use case.
Okay, so then we'll do that one first.
And yeah, that'd be great. That'd
I'll be getting with my guys this afternoon or sometime tomorrow, so that should be within the next couple of days. I'll reach out to you, independently if there are any issues or other questions or whatever, but cool.
Yep.
All right, sounds good. Thanks.
That's perfect. Thanks, Jonathan. And did I copy you on the template?
Yep, I'm on there.
Okay, perfect. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Jonathan. I'm just raising my hand to introduce some of the chat dialogue that was taking place there. Aubrey asked, is there any use case where someone, either a buyer or a seller, is using a proxy? I can address domains by proxy, which is the only proxy service I'm familiar with, is that domains by proxy as a listed registered name holder does not participate in any transfer operations. So that service has to be canceled prior to initiating any transfer or any change of control. I'm not sure if that's a general case for all proxy services, but it's certainly the case for that one. So, Bob, I guess if anyone has any strikingly different experiences with proxies, perhaps that could be at least, if it's a separate use case or maybe a variant of one of your existing use cases.
Okay, good point. Maybe we can try that at a couple of others and just see if it works. So that's essentially privacy services, right?
Yeah. And then Mikey had a question about are any of the use cases employing an escrow service?
No, they're not. Do you think we should?
Well, I guess my only question in response to Mikey's question would be if that falls within the umbrella of what we're trying to tackle with change of control, or if that's sort of kind of an outside third-party service that really shouldn't have an impact one way or the other. But, I plead ignorance on this one. I don't know how it would or would not affect. Mike, go ahead.
I think that it would be an interesting one to add to the pile because I've used proxy several times on some of the big domain transfers that I've done, and it adds a lot of layers to the process and actually, in a way, makes change of control clearer because there are usually contracts that point to the proxy service, et cetera, et cetera. So in terms of showing how a change of control is affected during a change of registrar, it's a useful use case to bring in.
Is that
that was for proxy, correct? Or escrow?
That was garbled. I couldn't tell. Two people were talking.
I'm sorry, I stepped over Bob there. Is that for proxies or for escrow? I think I lost track of which one we were talking about.
Escrow is the one that I'm familiar with. I don't use proxy services. And so, just to sketch it out, the way that it would work, at least the way it's worked for me, is that the transfer is done twice. It's done first to the escrow service, and then once the money and the domain are in the same place, then it's done again out of the escrow service to the gaining registrant's registrar.
Okay. Bob, do you think it's at this point in the game we can still add in that discussion, and maybe Mikey, you could assist?
Yeah, we actually have an escrow service here, so I'm just wondering if we might be able to just use that as to walk through this process. So yeah, let me take that one and give that a try and see if we can't do it.
Okay, excellent. Thanks. Okay, so I appreciate that, Bob, and for everyone that's working on compiling those, I think Jonathan and Simonetta and some of the others appreciate you, your help in that. We look forward to the PowerPoint, although 50 slides is going to be, I hope they go quickly. But that will probably be the first item on our agendas when we return from the holiday break. So if there are any other questions on this, otherwise we will move on and restart our discussion on the approach. Now, according to our work plan, this is the last session for hammering out the approach to our three charter questions, which, if we recall, we tackled charter question C and charter question B in reverse order in fairly short sequence, but then we spent the bar approaching since then on charter question A. My question for the group is we should continue charter question A with the goal of wrapping that up here in the next 30 minutes, and then perhaps spend another 10 or 15 minutes revisiting charter question B and C, and then towards the end of this call we can then say that we have something that is a solid approach. We can boil this mind map down to sort of an outline, and then or whatever is the most portable and convenient format, and send that out to the group for a final sign off on the list. Does that sound like a reasonable approach, everyone? Okay, Simonetta, go ahead.
I just had a thought on something that we should perhaps add to the approach, and that is basically we're going to have to review what's coming in through the public comment period to see if there's something that we need to add here, and that is just kind of missing just as a stepping stone, I guess.
Okay, and that's for all charter questions, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay, I see Mikey capturing that now. Good catch, Simonetta. And, of course, that presumes that we will start to receive some comments. We certainly could use some at this point. Any other Any other feedback on that, or we can just dive right in and continue our discussion of charter question A. So where we last left our heroes, Mikey, if we could scroll up just a touch. Just want to make sure that we're capturing everything with charter question A. I think that we have a fairly comprehensive handle on all of the information that we want to gather, the background. Oh, yeah, that expands quite a bit. The background, I think, is there. The investigation, as far as data that needs to be collected. I think that the change of control presentation that we'll see next time will be a good source of data, but are there other sources of data that we need to add to this particular list? Any comments or concerns that we're missing something? Okay. And then looking at all of the examples, I think, again, that's also part of the discussion that we'll have next week. Identifying applicable models in the country code space. Now, I believe that we had reached out to the CCNSO, but we had also asked a few individuals on this working group to lend us their expertise on this subject. I think McKaylee, for example, was one. I think Matt, perhaps? Maybe I'm picking on Matt a little bit. But I think there were a couple of folks that had indicated that they were willing to just write up or find a few examples and write those up. And we'll have to reach out to McKaylee and see if that was indeed what he was volunteering for. But I think it's important that we do get some feedback from, you probably shouldn't put Matt's name up there, Mike. Yeah, I think I was probably jump the gun on that one a little bit. The next topic on this particular issue would be drawing up an ideal process based on what we understand the current landscape to be and what we've identified as in our findings as potential security concerns or barriers to trade, I guess, or barrier friction in transacting in domain name registrations. And then I see that the next is next few items here are about sending that ideal process. And Mikey, I think we should probably, I know you would never let us get away with designing a process without flowcharts, but if we could explicitly add that we would want to have some visual representations of whatever process we come back with, I think that that's probably called for in this example. So
I'm loving that.
Yeah, I knew you wouldn't let us put something out there without a flowchart.
Although I will tell you that it's going to be a hard one to draw.
Yeah, possibly. But we may have to take it piecemeal. Oh, I remember why Matt's name popped into my head, and I'm sorry to pick on you, Matt, but you had raised an excellent point in a previous call. Regarding change of control that was not the result of activity on the secondary market,
yep,
but was part of more of a merger and acquisition transaction.
Yep.
And I thought that was something that was, up until the point you raised that was something that had been overlooked. So maybe if you could describe your experience with those types of examples.
Yeah, so it's actually not even that specific, frankly. It obviously can be, but just for a variety of reasons, tax reasons, legal reasons, structure reasons, all sorts of other things. Lots of times, corporate clients at least will need to update the registrar information on their domain names that really have nothing to do with the fact that they're buying or selling said domains. They're just sort of, for example, in a large global corporation that may have different divisions or different subsidiaries, some local business unit in, Belgium, for example, may register domains in their name, but then the main corporate office in London or whatever wants the name, you know, wants all of the Whois information to be standardized, so they update the Whois information to reflect the main corporate entity. So all sorts of examples like that.
But would that strictly be a change of control, or is that just more of updating of the registrant context?
Well, it probably depends on how we're defining change of control, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I thought we had drawn some parallels between change of control and registrant information.
Well, I think it's definitely a fuzzy logic problem, right? At what point does it tip over and become a change of control?
Right.
But I think that your experience in the corporate transactions is slightly different than what we're talking about in terms of more of a retail or wholesale aftermarket.
Yep, that's probably right.
Okay. I see something Mikey put down here, but I want to go to Rob next, who's in the queue. Go ahead, Rob.
Hi. Yeah, I mean, we've looked at the acquisition side of it from a slightly different angle, in that part of our overall growth policy is to take on the customers of failing, struggling, or just simply wanting to get out of the market web hosts and domain registrars. And obviously, as an accredited registrar, one of the things we like to do is move the domains from wherever they're currently registered into our systems. Now, our standard procedure for doing that is to email all the customers and tell them what's going on, to say that you'll surely be getting an EPP code and various emails. If you don't understand them, please call us, or if you do understand them, please action them, and if you want any help, you know, we've got a support system at blah. One of the biggest problems we have had in moving in sort of bulk, not really massive amounts, but some bulk levels, is not receiving EPP codes when requesting them, not receiving the I want to let it go emails when requesting them, not receiving the you must confirm these emails, deliberately misleading emails from certain registrars which say that you must, you know, you, if you don't want this transfer to go ahead, do this. But if you ignore this email, the transfer will go ahead, and then they automatically knack it 4 days later because you haven't logged in and clicked confirm, despite the fact their email explicitly says not that you don't need to do anything. And also getting, in some cases, the contact information for the admin updated, which has a default at a lot of registries of being the registry themselves. It's further complicated where previous transfers have taken place that had used a proxy service, because the amount of domains I've looked at recently that still have Directi's proxy service mentioned in the Whois contacts, yet have moved registrars at least twice since then. Now, I know what's supposed to happen is that you get your reminder to say, please update your details for the WDRP. But, of course, if those emails are going to a proxy service that isn't passing them on anymore, the end user's not getting them, so the end user's not getting at least the reminder. And they only find out this is a problem when they want to move registrar or they want to renew their domain name and you can't authenticate who they are.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Rob. Just trying to unpack some of that here and turn that... turn your comment into some specific action items. So would you say that, I mean, it sounds like some of those issues are related to the partial bulk transfer problem that we identified earlier.
It's not so much if it's bulk or single transfers. It's a combination of less than helpful registrars who obviously don't want to see their business go away to somebody else, and a lack of overall cross-registrar and registry definition of exactly what should happen. If everybody is told, you know, you must send the EPP code to the admin contact and the registrant contact, then that'd be great. But some send it to registrant, some send it to admin, some send it to both, some don't even send it to anybody. What I think is missing is a set of rules that everybody should have to follow.
Yeah, I agree. Just as an aside, the policy is very clear that you send to the EPP code should be sent to the registered name holder. which I find interesting and curious because every other instance of the policy refers to the transfer contact, which can be the either the registered name holder or the admin contact. So it is an inconsistency.
Yeah, but I mean, if you take the reseller club directory, they don't send it at all. They show it to you on screen, which means that the registrant, who has absolutely no access to the end directory system, only the reseller does, would never get their EPP code.
Yeah.
Only if they've got a compliant admin who's actually trying to help them.
Yeah. And I think Simonetta has a good point in the chat here, which is that the people reading the policy and the people implementing the policy are not always coming from the same areas of expertise. It's usually a legal or business person reading the policy and then a technical person implementing it. And it could be gaps in understanding there.
We came rather late to the party, as it were, in terms of accreditation, but we've dealt with 30, maybe more, registrars over the years. We still have accounts with a whole load of them. We still have some domains at GoDaddy. We still have domains at OpenSRS. We still have domains at Enom. There isn't a common implementation of transfers. There's certain things that are similar, but there's no common implementation, and that's the bit from a systems point of view, as well as explaining things to customer point of view, is quite difficult because we can't give them one set of instructions to move in and move out because it will depend who they're moving in from or out to.
Okay. Well, that's a lot to take in. It's good information. I'm just trying to figure out where it goes here in our flowchart for change of control. So maybe we can, I see Mikey furiously navigating the map here. Maybe we can, I think that there's a bit in there about different implementation inconsistency. Maybe we can expand a little bit on that point relative to the way EPP codes are disclosed or distributed. The way that FOAs are treated, and that, overall it just comes down to registrars using the transfer process or using the transfer process as a means to gain or retain customers. And I think that that's definitely not what it was intended. In fact, it sounds like it's almost counter to the intention of the transfer process, which was to foster competition and choice. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. It's basically a follow-up to the comment that Matt made, and I couldn't find it that quickly in the mind map. So maybe we already discussed and it's already listed there, but I guess one of the obvious issues that needs to be addressed in relation to item A is like a definition, what is meant by change of control, and if there would be any policy recommendations, what kind of changes would fall under that. Because I know as well, I think in the IRGP Part B discussions, I think we also discussed, for example, the case where someone gets married and changes their last name. Is that a change of control? Or how is that dealt with as it is a change of registrant? So I guess that would be part of the discussions on how do you define that concept, and are there different kind of scenarios that you would be looking at of different rules that apply to the different kinds of situations where you might have that occurring?
Okay, good point. And I see that there was something in the chat as well from Phil that noted that it's going to be difficult to tackle this if there's just so much variation in registrar practice. I agree, and I think that there's a couple of, I think Rob has identified just a couple of strategic surgical areas where some definition and recommendations and some registrar education could go a long way to smoothing out some of those differences. For example, if you're using EPP, clarify exactly how the EPP code must be delivered and to whom and by when. I think that the policy contains some ambiguity there or some inconsistencies there. And if we can smooth out some of those issues, that might, while it might not address everything that Rob is discussing, I think it goes a long way to surgically attacking a root cause of a lot of what he's seeing out there. And then before we went on this path, we were The problem with mind map, in my opinion, guys, I love it, but I think the problem is that it encourages ADD-like behavior where you can kind of jump around a little too quickly and lose the handle on certain threads. Going back to where we were just prior to that, Mikey had typed out something about holding a real-time workshop as part of our presentation of the ideal process to the ICANN community, and Simonette, I believe, in the chat, thought that that was a good idea as well. I agree, and I think that, you know, that should be a part of our coming out party, I guess, for this particular process. But my question is, when in the work plan would we hold that? We have, I think, identified the San Jose meeting as an area where we would solicit feedback from the community on the problem and some of their ideas for the approach to the problem. It seems like the opportunity to do this would be in Prague, to either do it there or to have some sort of a virtual outreach session where that would be held via via teleconference with a mind map going. So I think that if we assume that we're going to be on track with our work plan and releasing some sort of initial report, plus or minus in the area of Prague, then I think we should have something, a draft of a ideal process along with a draft of our flowchart that we could discuss at the ICANN meeting in Prague. Any thoughts on that, or any objections to that approach? Or, Marika, have I made just too many assumptions on our work plan to realistically expect that?
This is Marika. I actually just quickly pull up the work plan, and it would coincide very well, because we have foreseen, indeed, to present the initial report by Prague, and also includes a workshop where we would present the initial report to the community, but that could at the same time also include a meeting with the registrar stakeholder group or a specific session that would focus on that specific part of the report.
Okay, thank you. I guess my only concern with that is just more of an ICANN cultural concern, which is that by the time something is written into an initial report, it seems to have a certain degree of inertia. And so that taking an initial report and then taking it out to the community for comments and feedback, if there's something that's dramatically proposed at a workshop or in those types of feedback sessions, it really has to be fairly significant in order to, cause a complete rewrite of the initial report. So that's just, maybe that's just an editorial opinion on my part, but Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Brick. I mean, in that case, there's, of course, other ways to already discuss initial ideas around that on an earlier stage. For example, if this would be the first topic the working group tackles, you might already have an idea by Costa Rica on what the process might look like. And in that case, you could schedule a meeting with the registrar stakeholder group to just, talk around it or have a workshop and specifically invite representatives from the registrar stakeholder group to go through the thinking or the most current thinking at the time by the working group to get input in that way. Or if it's at a later date, indeed do it in a virtual manner where you have a webinar or a meeting call scheduled with the registrar stakeholder group to talk about the proposed process so that the working group indeed can still make adjustments before it goes out for public comment. So there are different ways, I guess, to accommodate that or deal with that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we're now 20 minutes before the top of the hour, and the question I would pose to the group is, do we see any other glaring omissions in our approach to charter question A? I think we spent a couple of calls on this. I think we have a good handle on what we want to do, and I think that we're flexible and we are allowing for the idea that we could alter this as the situation changes, and particularly in response to public comment or feedback received from the SOs and ACs and stakeholder groups. So we're going to close this off going once, going twice. Excellent. Thank you. That is definitely the largest of our three questions and will probably consume you know, the Pareto's distribution that will probably consume 80% of our attention during this PDP. But looking at the other 20%, and I hate to sound dismissive of Charter Question B and Charter Question C, but, you know, hey, that's the breaks, right? Item B, time-limiting FOAs, I think that we've going back here and just kind of dusting off our memories from a few calls back, we talked a little bit about what the issue was with item B, what we were trying to solve, what some of the various use cases and scenarios where this would come into play, existing practices, existing policies, understanding the concerns, and then I think that based on findings in those three or four areas, we would then make some sort of recommendations on whether or not we believe that this FOAs should be time-limited, or if they currently are, they should not be time-limited, and in any case, what a reasonable time limit or expiration date of an FOA should be if we determine that they are indeed a perishable document. So any other comments? I see Mikey's got his hand up. Go ahead, Mikey.
Yeah, I want to talk while I do this so I don't blind you all with the mind mapping, but I think what we might want to do is steal some of this later stuff and repeat it. Basically, you know, this is the beginning of the process, but we don't then finish it. We then don't do anything. And so if we were to pick from this memo, this menu up here of things that we're actually planning to do, I think we have to repeat some of those in order to actually get a product out the door. See what I mean, James?
I do see what you mean. It's a good catch. With respect to Charter Question B, it may not necessarily require a flow chart, but I think in general we need to close it off with some sort of what is our action and how do we present that to the community and, what do we take away from that? So
we could, at a minimum, take these two and repeat them. Let me show you what I mean, and then if you don't like it, you can take it out.
Well, I think it's the last three.
This one, too?
The one about, determining whether it's appropriate. I think that it's probably safe to assume that it is, since we're modifying an existing policy or examining an existing policy. But, I think it's... I think that's good.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and repeat those again for the third one, as long as we're on a roll, because, I think these we can cut down on some of these less complicated items, but I think we need something in our work plan that acknowledges that we have to do some drafting and come up with some materials and circle back to the community. So,
got it.
There you go.
Okay, good catch. And thanks for keeping us consistent. So aside from that, Mikey and team, any other additions to Charter Question B? Vanetta.
Actually, maybe another one that applies to all three of them is to kind of, at some point, I think we're going to have another round of feedback and comments, right? And if so, we would have to look at these and see, review our approach and maybe review what we've done so far and plan for that time and whatever the output of that is as well, right?
Yeah, I agree. And typically, those are fed back into our discussions, into our deliberations. And you know, in some cases, folks who are submitting public comments were participants on the working group and understand the approach that was taken and some of the tools and materials that were employed. And in some cases, they're not, in which case we make sure that it's not revisiting of ground that's already been covered, and it's more of an introduction of new novel concepts and data or information, or if it's something that the working group missed the first time around. We definitely want to capture it as a result of those comments. So I think Mikey's got a kind of an overall capture here for public comment cycles of how that feedback loop affects or plays back into the overall distribution and document how we deal with the comments. Yes, correct. Yeah, all this stuff I think is always going to be done in the open and, of course, frequently presented to the those that are interested in the community. Of course, that doesn't preclude the idea that some folks will still continue to, I want to say, throw rocks from the outside. You know, don't like what the working group is doing, don't like what they're coming up with. I think that's just kind of the nature of the multi-stakeholder environment. So any other thoughts on charter question B? So Mikey has very astutely picked up that we need to close off each charter question with a discussion of our action items, and Simonetta has identified where we need to leave a placeholder to incorporate public comments. Mikey, is that a new hand or is that from previously?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's an old one.
Yeah, I figure you've got so many things going on right now. I figured that was the case.
Sorry.
Okay, moving on then. We have a few more minutes. We'll move on to charter question C. And I think that this is one that we identified possibly as low-hanging fruit, that we could get some immediate feedback specifically from registrars and registries. This is more of an operational question of how they refer to one another. And I think we identified fairly early on that this is mostly a transparent issue for end users, for registrants, and other stakeholders. Not saying that they don't have an opinion in that in this area, but just that it probably doesn't excite their interest one way or the other. So assuming that we have also captured the idea that we will solicit feedback, deliberate, issue our recommendations according to what we established for the other two charter questions, and then incorporate that public comment feedback cycle that Simonetta identified. Are there any other concerns about charter question C? Lowry.
Yeah, thanks. In looking at that question, I mean, at first, you know, there's the automatic instinctive answer, well, of course. And then you get beyond that and you say, well, how would we demonstrate that indeed it does streamline? Is that another place where doing some sort of use case or some sort of process scoping, process exploration will actually show us that, you know, in this case there's 27 steps and in this case there's 12 when doing it between, you know, registrar and registry. So I'm not quite sure how it is we demonstrate that yes, it is, or no, you know, it was anecdotally reasonable, but no, it really doesn't make anything easier. And I'm so that's the question I'm sort of asking. Thanks.
Can I? Okay, good question. Can I just maybe put my registrar hat on for just a moment here and respond with, I don't know that it's a streamlining issue necessarily, but it's more of a concern about scaling as the number of registries grow, especially in, you know, in advance of the new GTLD program. Just that it becomes, like many individuals who have accounts with, let's say, Amazon and Apple and Google and Yahoo and all the different online sites you would have, I think that registrars also, and perhaps registries as well, find that that may be a challenge to scale that that many-to-many relationship as it grows. So perhaps the response, Aubrey, would be to impress upon the registrars that we really need to explain the harms of this, either current or anticipated harms of this, to the community and make sure that we're demonstrating either through use cases or maybe it's just a descriptor that this is a problem worth solving and that it's something that even though it's not a pain that's experienced by registered name holders, it is something that registries and registrars are looking to change or not change, I guess. I don't want to presume the outcomes, but is that going down the road towards what you were looking for, Aubrey?
Yes and no. That gives us another question to answer. But if we have to answer the question that is in our charter, we also need to cover streamlining. Now, obviously, streamlining contributes to scalability in some sense. But and so, yes, I mean, I said no, but then yes, in that producing cases that show that that something makes it better, that something makes it scalable, that something makes it work better for the users and registrants, perhaps, because there's less confusion, there's less time, there's less I don't know what, is all valuable. But I think that's the construct that we have to think of it in, is what are the benefits, what are the costs, and how do we show them?
Okay, but in either case, I think it kind of falls to the registries and registrars to make that case or dispute that case, correct?
Certainly, they're the ones that have the knowledge on what how it affects it. So certainly, it would be a use case if it was between registrars and registries, yes.
Okay. Unless it's so sufficiently optimized the process that registrars felt like, you know, they could then lower, you know, overall prices or something silly like that, I guess.
Yeah. Or I'm totally speculating because I don't know. Are there error cases or other problems that would decrease, whether that has an external effect or not, I don't know. But you know, are there problems that are caused now other than, you know, it being, yes, I have to keep a database of all my passwords because they're all different, you know, going back to your case. So I keep a database. So is it just that it makes it easier? Are there consequences of it being the way it is now that would be less the case if it were all uniformly changed? And so those are the questions that I think, you know, I certainly don't know the answer. I'm not even sure what the proper questions are, but I think it's framing is, why do this? Is it just a matter of convenience, or is there a material effect to the registries, to the registrars, and perhaps even through some second-order effect to the registrants that doing this affects? And that we have to show. And as if we're saying this is worth doing, not only in terms of convincing the registrars, which is important, but just in terms of the general question, is this worth doing given its cost? In terms of global system cost, then why? As I say, instinctively, it seems to me, of course this is the right thing to do, but that's not the right answer.
Right. Otherwise, it wouldn't have made it, graduated this far and became
that's
a charter
right.
question.
Would have just done it.
Right, exactly. Okay, thanks. I think that Mikey's been typing furiously, and I think that he's captured most of your concerns are accurately reflected here in what he's changed, but if they're not, maybe you could take a look here and make sure that we get everything there. And then I'll move on to Simonetta.
I'm just adding to what Avery was just saying. I think the step that we have in A, and I think in B as well, is just understand why we're even looking at this question, which would kind of explain to us what the benefit is of changing it, because there must be a story why this item made it into this PDP process in the first place. So understand what that is, and then you can define what the benefit would be of changing it. And it could be as simple in terms of the demonstration piece that Avery was asking for. It could be as simple as to just basically show a quick graph of like this registrar, this is currently the database structure, and then adding another one takes X amount of time and time costs XYZ. Now think about adding 500 or 1,000 new registries. What would this do for basically every single registrar all around the world? And there you have your use case, maybe if that's what it is. But if we just ask why are we even looking at this question, we'll probably get to the benefit that way.
Okay. Good, and I see that Mikey, I think, has captured this concept for the others, which is, you know, finding out where, you know, what is the problem statement that's behind this question. And for some of that, when we get to that point in our deliberations, we may need to go back to the, not the previous sequences of IRTP, but the task force that set up these this sequence of PVPs. Now we're going back a couple of years, and revisit some of those documents and make sure we understood the genesis of these charter questions, and make sure that we're accurately capturing them in our discussions and our requests for information. Okay. Oops, I see Marika. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. In relation to your comment of going back to the documents, as I think what I've basically tried to do as well in the issue report and really trying to dig into these issues, but I have to admit it was quite difficult as there are a number of documents that were developed by the different task forces and working groups that looked at that. And also, you know, for example, I think on one issue, the only thing I managed to find or where it came from was an email that was sent to a mailing list. So it's over time, it hasn't really, they haven't really kept track on, you know, what was the original problem and taking that forward. It's like different pieces that I hope have been put together to a certain extent in the report. But I think we also have to be realistic that as some of these issues were raised quite a few years ago, in certain cases, maybe it is no longer an issue or the reason why it was originally raised doesn't exist anymore. So I'm not really sure whether that applies to these issues, but I think if you look at some of the other IRTP issues, it's a valid question for the working group to ask, are these questions still valid, seeing, you know, the time that has passed and possible other measures that have been taken over time?
Okay, thanks. And I think that we will be reaching back for those touchstones, I think, throughout this process and making sure that we're being faithful to the original intent of including these. Or if we believe that the question is no longer, or the issue is no longer operative, we should, I think that that puts the burden on us to demonstrate why we believe that's the case and why we feel that that the charter question has become obsolete in the intervening time. Okay. So with that, we have 3 minutes until the top of the hour. I think that we have a good list here of an approach for all three charter questions. I think that we should then send this out to the mailing list for markup and review with the understanding that folks may or may not have their full attention allocated elsewhere during the next 2 weeks. Our next call, if you recall our previous discussion, we will not have a meeting on next week, which is the 27th of December. We will, is that correct, Marika? We will not meet on the 27th. We will meet on January 3rd. That's correct. Yes?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so we're taking 1 week off, and that is next Tuesday. We will resume our discussions on January 3rd. Presumably, the bulk of that call will be occupied by a presentation from Mr. Mountain and the group that is working on case studies for change of control. The week following, January 10th, may be a little problematic for me, so I've reached out to Avery to see if what her schedule looks like, and perhaps she can take the lead on that meeting. But let me know if that's a problem, Avery. We can probably coordinate offline. If that's going to be an issue. With that, I would say, you know, to everyone that is celebrating or observing various holidays, to enjoy your time off. And if you're traveling, please stay safe and try to spend the minimal amount of time on ICANN issues that you can possibly get away with. And so thanks, everyone, and have a great day and a great week off.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, James.